ॐ भद्रं हरणे विष्णुयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षधीर्यचक्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितन्यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नः सार्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः It's our second class on the Alapta Shanti chapter, the chapter 4 of the Mandukya. There's one more place here.
You did the first prayer.
You did the first, yeah, we did the first verse. First verse, what's the matter? Oh, first verse and the second verse are prayer verses. We're doing the second verse now, okay? Asparsha-yoga-vai-nama vai-nama Sarva-sattva-sukho-hitaha Sarva-sattva-sukho-hitaha Avivado-viruddhascha Avivado-viruddhascha Deshitastam-namamyaham Deshitastam-namamyaham Asparsha-yoga-vai-nama Sarva Sattva Sukha Yataha Avivadaha Aviruddha Cha Deshitaha Tam Namami Aham. Good. The first verse was to the Guru, to the Guru Sisha relationship, pranams to the Guru, pranams to the teacher, to the Acharya, to the Sampradaya, to the teaching methodology. This one is to the teaching itself. So he says, Asparsha Yogaha Vai Nama. This teaching actually, which is called by those who know that Vai Nama, this Nama, which is very well known within the tradition, so Vai Nama. Asparsha Yogaha means that yoga, that teaching, that knowledge, which is Asparshaha. There's no touching. There's no subject-object. There's no sambandha. Asparshaha means the same as asangaha. If I say the atma, the self, is asanga, means it's not connected with anything. You know, like space is asanga. Space is asanga. Everything moves through it, but nothing touches it. Like that, the atma is asanga, but it's also your being, right? Being your being, there's nowhere for you to go to reach it, right? And there's nothing for you to do to reach it, because it's already you, right? So the asparsha, there's no contact to be made. There's no place to go. There's nothing to clean. There's all these various things that we can do. We can go someplace to reach a place. That requires some action. We go to reach a place. We try to clean something in order to make it shiny. We try to create something. There's a variety of things that we can actually do, right? To create, to clean, to reach, you know? But here the self, we're talking about your being. And your being is asparsha. Asparsha means it's a sangha-like space. What are you going to do to it? And how are you going to get to it? How are you going to polish it? Imagine polishing space. You were going to clean up the space. You can clean the air, you can sweep the dirt, you know, you can do so many things as long as there's some kind of form there. But how are you going to clean up your being or reach your being or create your being even, because you're already there? So if we say Asparsha Yoga, that means it's the teaching for which there is nothing to be done, there's something to be known. There's nothing, nowhere to go, nothing to do, something to be known. So that's the asparsha. Remember this Sprish. Doesn't really matter. Sprish means to touch, right? To contact, to touch. So negates it. Asparsha Yogaha. So it says, this is Asparsha Yogaha Vayanama, as is well known in the tradition. Sarva Sattva Sukaha, he says, Sattva here means all beings. Sarva Sattva, all beings. It is Sukha. It is Ananda. It is fullness, happiness, Sukha, pleasing for all beings. Sarva Sukha, all human beings, all beings actually, because it's the very, very swarupa of the self, the very nature of the self is Ananda. And it's an ananda, which is asparsha. Means there's nothing you can do about it. Sparsha, that's basically what asparsha means. There's nothing you can do about it. There's something for you to know. But nothing to do about it means you can't reach it, you can't clean it, you can't improve it, you can't create it. One thing is we start understanding what really the nature of the self is, that's something that can be very liberating for us as Westerners. You know, we can't improve it is one big thing. No improvement possible. But you know what else is a huge relief? You also can't make it worse. Okay? You're freed of being able to make something better. And you're freed of the fear of being able to make it worse. So it's very, very liberating. And not only that, unlike space, when we think of space, we don't think of space as sukha or ananda. We think of space as just neutral. And when I think of space, even though it's a sangha, space is a sangha, it's asparsha. You know, you can't wet it, you can't burn it, you can't chop it, you can't do anything to space. You can't move it, it's already everywhere. Right? Nothing you can do to it. But when you think of space, it's neutral. Right? You don't think of space as ananda. It would be walking through the space would be such a pleasurable experience. You don't think about space as ananda. But the nature of your being is ananda. Ananda, another thing, when we say sukha, sarva sattva sukha, is something which is here, this asparsha yoga, which is moksha, which is liberation, which is because asparsha is the nature of your being, nothing to do, nothing to do. But the nature of your being is ananda. But it's not just the nature of your being is ananda. The nature of all beings is ananda because, in fact, there's only one being. But there's not many spaces. See, the thing, space is such a wonderful bhagavan, you know. We use space and some, we have various drishtantas illustrations that are so very powerful. If you think of, in terms of the five elements that we have in this creation, we've got the earth, you know, which is maybe the most gross. The earth is something that can be perceived by all of your sense organs, all five sense organs. You can smell it, you can taste it, you can see it, you can touch it, you can hear it. So all five sense organs are engaged in experiencing the earth. But if you go to, if you go up one to water, water doesn't have any scent. Scent belongs to the earth. So as we go a little bit more subtle, and water pervades the earth. So water is one up in terms of subtlety. Right? We can't smell it. But the other four sense organs are engaged. We can taste it, and we can see it, and we can feel it. You know. But now say we go up one more to fire. Fire we can't taste and we can't smell, so fire is more subtle. And fire can heat the earth and it can heat the water, it can pervade. But it's more subtle. Now I can only see it and I can feel it and I can hear it crackle. But now if I go to one more element, say to air now, I can't see air. Right? I can feel air, I can feel the wind blow. Right? And I can hear it as the air can crackle. I can hear the wind blowing and I can feel it. But now only two sense organs are available for air. And now if I go just to space, we say that the only thing that we can talk about space, what its guna is, what its quality is only sound, because we'll say sound travels through space. But really, we can't see space, we can't feel space, we can't touch space. We move in space. Space is all pervasive. But it is the most subtle, right? Even in terms of our ability to see it, to experience it, we can't feel it. We can't feel it. We can't taste it. Right? Sound moves through it, so we can kind of talk like that. So now, space being of the five elements, the most subtle, it pervades everything, all of the other elements. And being more subtle, all of the other elements don't touch it. Right? They exist in it, but they don't touch it. But space exists in my awareness. I'm aware of space. I illumine space. I'm aware of space. I'm aware of the air. I'm aware of the fire. I'm aware of the water. I'm aware of the earth. And so the conscious me, the conscious being, is the most subtle. Right? It's the most subtle. I illumine even space itself. And so this self, so there's something similar. Space is the most subtle of the elements. And I'm more subtle than even space. And so if the space itself is a sangha, you know, what am I? You know, space is, but space is so such a wonderful thing to have the experience of space. Because you can understand the asangatvam, how space is not attached, nothing touches it. But space is not away from anything. And like that, awareness that illumines space is not away from everything, but it's pervasive to everything, but it's asanga, it's untouched. Think of it, think if your being were not a sparsha or asanga, the conscious being that you are, somehow was touched or did get into a sambandha. Sambandha means does get connected with things. What would I be doing? What would be involved in disconnecting it? Because actually, every moment you are fresh. All experience moves through you. Every single moment you are absolutely fresh. Leaving every experience, past, present, and future, is flowing through you, who remain as the presence of the present. So you're never touched in any way. That's just it's the fact of it. We don't notice it because the ahankar, the I notion, is too engaged. You know, with too identified with the body, mind, sense organs. So you don't notice these simple things. But when you do notice them, they're there to be seen. That's the whole thing to understand about the whole teaching of Advaita Vedanta, of the Upanishads. It is there to be seen. It's just we have to slow things down and point it out. When you point it out, they say, aha, you see that. There's nothing not to see there. Mm. That's why the Upanishads are viewed as a pramana, as a means of knowledge. You know, they're a pramana. There's nothing to argue about in terms of a pramana. Like, for instance, you have eyes that are working. Say your eyes are working, and I hold this up, you know, and now you see this kind of white cup. You know, just a white Crate and Barrel cup. That's all. So it's just a white cup. Now, this is not an argument. Right? It's just a simple cup. You know, we're not trying to make a deal out of it. Your sense organs are looking at this white cup, and we're all functioning in the world with this being a cup. Right? It's not an argument, because it is here, and it is here to be seen, and your sense organs are there to perceive it, and you gain knowledge of this thing, and then you respond to that what you see. Like that. Your being, who you are, is here to be recognized. It is here. It's not somewhere else. And so it's just a matter, it's not a matter of argument. Your nature is not a matter of argument. It's a matter of knowledge. Right? Because it's not hypothetical. It's not a theory. So when I say the Upanishads are a pramana, it means that they're a means of knowledge to point your mind in a direction to recognize something. we have to point, the Upanishads have to point to these things because your mind is not used to recognizing, to dealing with the totality of your experience in that way. Your mind is simply trained to look out through your sense organs and to be engaged in subject-object relationship. Just poke her a little bit.
You're a good one.
It's okay, Johnny. We'll just poke you for snoring. You just relax.
Snoring.
You just relax. It's fine. Okay, so that's exact. I mean, that's what this verse, and it's what we're going to be. The next four or five verses are on this. What I'm talking about. So I'm not off subject here. I'm trying to tell you what we're in for here. Yourself is here. Yourself is here. It's something that needs to be recognized. Yeah. It is not a philosophy. It's not a philosophical discussion. Within duality, we have philosophical discussions. What is this? What is that? Within science, we're trying to figure things out, you know, that can be figured out. But at least we have a pramana. We're using a pramana, our pramanas, to figure these things out. But if we're able to use our pramanas, our means of knowledge, right, then we're learning. We're learning things that are actually here. Yeah. Here, we're learning what is actually here in terms of my own being. Right? And your being is not something that is going to be reached. It's something that's already present. So this is also something that's happened in our language. Because in India, when the student approaches the teacher, in all the Upanishadic stories, when they approach the teacher, the question is, in one way or another, the question that the student asks is, who am I? That's basically who am I, really? And I think that the meaning of this question has been misinterpreted, you know, because the question is actually very simple. You're going to your teacher, your guru, within that Vedic tradition, to find out about me. This person, if I'm standing before you and you're my guru, and I say, is there anything about me that survives death? Do I survive death? That's what I'm asking. Do I survive death? It's not, is there a big capital S self somewhere? It's, who am I? Who is this person? And what is my relationship to my body, my mind, my sense organs? What is my relationship to God and to this creation? That's what I want to know. Who am I? What am I doing here? What's the truth of all of this? And I've found, at least in my own experience over the years, is that a lot of students, the who am I question has become different than that. It's become not so much who am I, but where is the big capital self that I need to experience? I want to have an experience of that big capital S self that is somewhere that I can have as a meditative experience, not who am I who is here right now. And so that type of, I don't know how that happened, but it did. Okay. Because that's not really what the Upanishads are about. The Upanishads are very personal. Who is this person that is here? Not that I have to search for somebody else, a big S self. You know, the little S self and the big S self. What is my nature? And so if you start thinking like that, then this whole teaching, the way you listen to this teaching becomes very different. Because you're not waiting for you to have some astral travel or go into some other plane in order to meet yourself. So you're listening, the way you listen is going to be different. And so here when they say the Sparsha Yoga, it's basically, there's nothing for you to do. There's nowhere for you to go. It is you that we are talking about. Right? And there's nothing to be done there. There's only something to be known. And that teaching itself, the nature, the very swarupa of your being, is not only ananda, it brings joy to all beings. Right? Your very nature is this sukha for all beings, for all beings who gain this knowledge, it is sukha, because you, sukha means happiness or fullness, because you recognize who you are. You recognize that you are free of dukkha. In this knowledge, in recognition of yourself, is that you are actually, your being is actually free of dukkha, of suffering. That you are free of suffering, and that your being itself is so whole and so complete and so beautiful. It couldn't be better. It's not something you can improve on. And it's nityam. Nityam means you, this being, the me that you are, it's not subject to time. And so it's hitam. It's actually the recognition, the gaining of self-knowledge is hitam, means it is a blessing. It's beneficial. It's not like the sukha you gain, the happiness you gain in samsara. That's not necessarily a blessing, because the ananda, the happiness you gain in samsara, comes and goes. You know, there's one, you can count on it. It'll come, but it will go. That's just the way of it. That's the way of the samsara. So the sukha you gain here is not necessarily a blessing, because it's wrought with the pain of its demise.
Mm.
Right? Whereas this sukha is a blessing because it doesn't leave. It's a blessing because your being is timeless, is free from change. So it says, this what we know, this teaching, which is a Sparsha Yoga, is sarvasattva sukha. It is ananda. It is fullness for all beings, because I am the self of all beings. And it is hitam. It's a blessing for all beings because it doesn't go away. And not only that, it is avivadaha. Means there's nothing here to debate. There's no debate, because it has to do with knowledge, not opinion. These are not just ideas. You have this idea and you have this idea. This has to do with knowledge, and it can only... we're not talking about knowledge of things in the world that are existing in time and space. Things in the world that are existing in time and space can be actually viewed. When we get into more into Maya, we'll see this, but anything within time and space can actually be viewed from an infinite... literally infinite number of standpoints. Anything in the world, you know, can be viewed from an infinite number of standpoints, and it's involved in literally an infinite number of relationships, and also it is going through an endless series of changes and modifications. So actually, when we think about trying to know something in the world, that is very problematic, and most people in science, and this started with the Jains, in fact, very ancient darshana in India. One of their great contributions is kind of like whatever they know within Maya, within the world, is so it seems. Always. They never say, this is how it is, because they say everything that you experience here, you know, is infinitely interrelated and can be viewed from an infinite number of standpoints. And so they always say, seemingly so. And in science also, and in fact, in some ways this makes it difficult for us when we come to gaining knowledge of something that is non-dual. In this world, the science will continue to go on collecting and broadening its knowledge and its understanding, you know. And new knowledge will often, and expectedly so, replace old knowledge, right? It goes on growing and changing and becoming more interconnected as we go along. And that's expected. And in fact, to think that it's not going to be that way is kind of naive. It would be naive because of the infinite number of connections, you know, infinite number of relationships, infinite number of subtleties, so to speak. And so to think that you know anything really, you know, is suspicious. Somebody says they know, You should be able to say, you know, this works in this situation for now. This is useful knowledge for now. This is useful. Even though it goes on being negated and negated and negated, but we understand that and we accept that. But here, when we're talking about the nature of the self, we're not talking about something that has parts. We're not talking about something that has multiple standpoints or can be viewed from an infinite number of directions. That's not the nature of what is non-dual. There are no standpoints. There are no directions. There are no parts to conscious being, to your being. You can't even use language in the same way to say that your being is big or small or red or yellow, or I can look at it from the back or look at it from the front or look at it from the sides. None of that applies. All of those concepts are fine within time and space. But time and space exist kind of like in the same realm as the dream. If you have a dream or an imagination, it comes, you know, time and space comes with a dream. Time and space is one of the elements, space, air, fire, water, earth. Conscious being doesn't have anything to do with time and space. And so the recognition of yourself is going to be different. And the way the pramana, the knowledge, is utilized and handled is going to be different. And it's asking your mind to do something very different. It's asking your mind now to, instead of looking out or looking laterally or see how this thought differs from this thought or this experience differs from this experience, we're not looking laterally and we're not looking externally. We're now being directed to recognize the one who is present to all of those experiences as they change one after another after another after another. So now we're not looking out and we're not looking laterally. We're looking at the nature of the subject me that is present to every experience that comes and goes. And because I am present to every experience that comes and goes, I can't be any of them. Because they come and go and I don't. And yet they're not away from me. Right? The experiences are not away from me. Like anything that comes into my mind, it's not away from me. But it comes and goes and I remain. So that's asking now for to do something, a differentiation between me and all of the experiences. There's nothing lateral about that. See what I mean? There's nothing looking outward. Has to be a recognition of me, the one who is here, and I recognize as these things are pointed out that actually my being is changeless and free amidst all of this. And then I start noticing, having that viveka, discrimination, I start noticing, what am I like? Versus, what am I like dressed in all of these experiences? You know, like what if I'm thinking, you know, what am I like? Well, you know, I like these green pants and this blouse and this, you know, necklace. That's what I'm like today. No? I'm like this thought. Right? I'm like my cold. Or, you know? But we don't even think about this because we don't think about it until it's pointed out. No, that's not true. Whatever I'm wearing, and just from the standpoint of the body is not taking on this dress, right? And I am not taking on my perceptions. And I am not taking on my moods or my emotions or my thoughts. These are all experiences. My experiences, but I've never bothered to look at that me. And so now when I start looking, how am I going to look? Not through my eyes, because my eyes look outward. Not through my ears. Those are all for all of these sense objects. How am I going to look through my mind? I'm not going to look through my mind either. I illumine my mind. So the mind has to perform, the teaching has to do this trickery in a way, this magic, to tell the mind, show the mind, make the mind recognize its own nature of being illumined. Your mind has to recognize that, I am illumined. Right? I am known. Who's the knower? Who is the one that's illumining this mind? And there are so many prakriyas in the Upanishads, teaching methodologies to keep pointing out to you, to make you see, I'm always here. And then to recognize your being in your own right, you know? But to recognize then that you're even more subtle than space. You're more subtle than space. You're a changeless being. And if I'm changeless being and all experiences are coming and going in me, where is there any death for me? And not only that, if I'm free from all experiences that are coming and going, right? If I'm free from all experiences that are coming and going, what makes me different from you who are also free of all experiences that are coming and going? Because you can't be an experience that's coming and going. And your being is more subtle than space. So how can this me, what is conscripting me, giving me form? When we did the meditation today, what I was trying to help you to recognize is, as you just focus on your own presence, focus on the breath, focus on your own presence, focus on the body, and you're focusing on your own being, that doesn't have, that is not the experience of the body. It's not the experience of the shape of the body. It's not the experience of the breath. It's the experience of me. Just me. Conscious being. Right? And so now you start to recognize, I am always the same. I am always that conscious being. And then you say, well, what am I like? What is this conscious being that is me like? And then you can point, use words. Words are inadequate, but still, you know, like say if I say, it's so simple, but it's so strong. It's so unassuming and yet so confident. These are not, we use these words in duality, but these are just kind of pointing to your swabhava, your nature. You know? Like you would think, if I'm using those words and you're with yourself, oh, why is she saying like that? Yeah, we could say that. It's not that, you know, the words are just kind of somehow pointing, right? So, this is something, you are something to be recognized. It's not a vivada. There's not two ways about it, because there's not two standpoints once you're in the non-dual. So it's avivada and it's aviruddha. There's no opposition. You have, you know, you say it's white, you say it's black. It's neither white, it's neither black. You say it's tall, you say it's short. No, it's not tall, it's not short. You know? You say it's born, you say it's unborn. It's neither born or unborn. It's free from time. So where's the viruddha? It's aviruddha. That way it doesn't, knowing your being, knowing what is here, is not in opposition to any darshana. It's not in opposition. Because the darshanas themselves are taking place within duality. And so, as long as for them duality is real and it's taking place within duality, in that sphere, they're arguing with each other, as we'll see when we go into these next few verses. They're arguing with each other, like the Sankhyas are arguing the Vaisheshikas and the Nyayayikas. And so, subtle arguments. And they totally, they're viruddha, they're totally opposed to each other. Yeah. And the Vedanta will say, well, yeah, we agree with both of you. We agree with both of you, because it's Maya. Because in that realm, it's mine. We don't have any contest. It's fine. No problem. So then it says, avivadaha, aviruddha. We're not avivada. It means we're not taking a position for or against anybody. You all exist within the realm of Maya, but there's no debate here because there's a pramana, there's something to recognize, something to know. And he says that Asparsha Yoga, which is Deshitaha, which is the Deshitaha, which is the teaching, the thing to be taught, the Upanishads. Deshitaha means that which is taught. So this is Asparsha Yoga by Nama, which is so well known, so well understood by this term, Asparsha Yoga, this Nama, is so well known in the Sampradaya, right? This which is taught, Namami Aham, Tam Namami Aham, I prostrate to that.
Mm.
I prostrate
mm.
to that.
Mm.
That teaching,
mm.
teaching of the Upanishads, which we know as Asparsha Yoga, which is Hitam, which is a blessing for all beings, and is the very, which is on both Ananda for all beings and a blessing for all beings. Can never disappoint in any way because it's timeless. Because the nature of yourself is that Ananda. And so who doesn't want Ananda? Who doesn't want love? It's not boring. What if you say, oh, your time, your being is all Ananda, it's all wholeness, fullness, love. All the time? When I get bored, you know, the one thing that doesn't bore you is the wholeness of the love of your own being. That which is the most, the beloved does not bore you. Okay. The beloved that you once thought was the beloved can become boring. When it's objectified and the beloved part drops off and you're left with the person. Or the thing, right? But the beloved itself, what is beloved, is not boring.
Wow.
You ever had that experience? I mean, I remember for myself, some, when you have those moments that it's just, you're so whole, feel so whole. It's all samsara, but anyway. You feel so whole and so complete, and then your mind, you just never want it to end. So it's not anything that could ever be born. You know it will end. You never want it to end because it's so sacred, it's so beautiful, you know. Ananda or love or fullness is not something that is boring. But to understand your own nature, which is not right, I mean, your own nature right now, at this moment, it's not a bliss bubble, it's not an in-love state, you know. In-love states and bliss bubbles and all of these things, those are all come and go. Those are mental modifications, they're mental states, right? But you are the source of those, all of that variety of states, from extreme love to just fullness or wholeness. You have to recognize the me, the self, that is always there. The thing to do is whenever you have a happy moment, you have a happy moment or a peaceful moment, instead of looking out at whatever's making you peaceful, that's brought about that shantavritti, you just close your eyes and go into your own self and differentiate you, the one who's aware of that shantavritti. Subtle, but it's different. You're not the shantavritti. Shantavritti means a peaceful thought.
Mm-hmm.
You're not that shantavritti. The shantavritti totally resonates with you. It resonates with you. It's fine. You're totally comfortable with that. Except that it's finite and it's going to go away. But you're totally comfortable with it. But that's a time to just look at yourself and see the difference between your own presence and that shantavritti. And then when you have a negative vritti, a depressed vritti or a sorrowful or agitated vritti, do the same thing. And recognize, I am still there in exactly the same way. And in fact, it doesn't matter what type of vritti it is. They don't cover me at all. They don't. None of them cover me. But you have to notice that because the mind is only used to looking at the changing moods and emotions and experiences. That's what it's used to focusing on. Right? It's not used to focusing or recognizing my own being that is always present. But as you do that, as you start to do that, I, myself, comes more to the foreground, Because I'm used to myself. I become used to myself, and then I notice that I'm changeless. And then all of the other things that this knowledge has to give rests on this, on the changeless wholeness of your own being. And that my being is changeless and whole and complete, and nothing touches it in any way, and that's true for you and you and you, and true for all beings, then this me that I am is only one. It is me, but there's only one of me. Your sense of me, this very intimate sense of me, right, belongs to you. That is the nature of your being, this me experience. But this me experience is Ishvara. It's the self of Ishvara. The whole creation is a manifestation of me, right? And so this me that is me, right, all of the jivas, all of these jivas, always say me, because they are this me. There's only one me. And this me is the self of the whole creation. So, but I have to recognize the self for any of that to make sense. Then it just becomes philosophical. If I can't be speaking from this standpoint, then we can't go on to really see what all of this is, this Maya, Ishvara. And I'm the self of all beings, that all beings exist in me, all that beautiful things that this has to unfold. So that's the second verse. First verse was to the Guru, and this verse is, it's really a very complete, beautiful verse. Now, but in the next verse, which we'll see next week, he starts dissecting some of the darshanas and their position, you know, letting them destroy each other, and then steps in after the two have finished off each other, and he'll come in.
I do have a question. Yeah. Can we ask questions?
In a minute we can. Okay. So we'll see next week. Let's have a prayer first, and then we'll ask questions. Swasti prajabhya paripalyantam nyayena margena mahimahishaha gopramanebhya shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parajanyaha prithivi sasya shalini desho yam shobharahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritangamaya Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vishishate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Hari Om. Hi Anne, hi Barbara, hi Dechen, hi Danya, hi John, hi Catherine. Nala and Maitreya, Arisa, I said hi to you. I just saw your note, Tara. Yeah. Oh, Antoine and Linda.
Thanks. This unchanging quality that we can somewhat locate or identify.
Uh-huh.
And even though for the most part, it seems unchanging, but there's still a doubt in the sense that it seems to be limited by at least birth, that much I can get the sense of, because I don't remember being before I was born.
Right.
So therefore, it seems to have a beginning point. And so, since the teaching, which how you presented it, seems to be directed to convincing the mind that it's pervaded by this awareness, yet where was that quality before I was born?
Right.
So therefore, at that point, the mind thinks, well, every other experience that I can trace to, you know, I can't even say from birth, I have to somehow locate it around the age of 11 because I don't really have memories before then. So,
that's right.
So,
I'll tell you what the problem is. The problem is that when we think, it's a semantics also, when we think of awareness, we think of awareness as a knower. And so, for me to be aware means to be aware of something, rather than just the awareness which illumines the mind. So the knowership belongs to the mind and the sense organs, not to awareness itself. It's kind of like a good example that we use is just like the sun illumines the world, right? It illumines whatever comes into its range, but it is not performing a function of knowing. It's just whatever comes into its scope is known. And so otherwise, just think of this. Now, if awareness was the knower, then I should know everything you're thinking of. Because if there's only one awareness, I should know whatever Ishwara knows. But that's not true. I don't know what you know. I don't know what Tibby knows. I don't know what anybody else knows. I only know from the standpoint of this mind, because the mind and sense organs are what actually, if I can use the word, it's kind of a tricky word to use, but reflect consciousness. You know, but they're the instrument. Like, say, if I realize that my sense organs themselves are objectified, I know if I can see, I know if my eyes are working, I'm aware of my ears, you know. Then I say, well, my mind is aware of my eyes, you know. And if my mind is, for instance, daydreaming, then my sense organs are all here, but they're not being used. They're just instruments. Right? So I have to use my sense organs. My mind has to use and be hooked up with the sense organs for them to work. But then I say, and the mind also, so the mind itself is illumined. Right? But the mind is the one that has the thoughts, has the knowership, has the enjoyership. But it enjoys consciousness. In deep sleep, the mind is in a manifest condition. There's no knowership in deep sleep. Right? So we don't consider awareness a knower at all. There would be so many, if awareness was a knower, there would be all kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. So the knowership belongs to the upadi, so it means the conditioning adjuncts. And that's why, say you have one me, one conscious being, you know, but then all of these jivas, each one says, I'm the conscious being, I'm the conscious being. And all the animals also, all of the plants, anything that has subtle body is going to have that sense of me. And the whole creation that has sattva running through it, the whole creation is like an infinite mind. Yeah. I certainly don't have that experience. So now what we can, one thing that's helpful is sometimes when we do the guided meditation, you can do on your own. So when you're contemplating and you make your mind quiet and you just notice your own presence. We did some of this today, but I didn't point this one thing out. You ask yourself, am I this me, conscious being, that am I doing anything? Am I knowing anything? You'll see that the thoughts that are coming through, they're known, but are you doing anything to know them? You simply are just there. You're not performing any activity at all.
Well, there's something quite unremarkable, it seems, about that sense of me.
Unremarkable?
Unremarkable in the sense that it doesn't, apart from shining,
yeah,
it in itself doesn't seem to do anything.
Doesn't do anything except it does everything, because because of the nature of this creation, like let me give you an example, just from the standpoint of an individual, to me here, if I ask you right now to imagine a beautiful meadow with deer running through it, and you know, it's just a beautiful meadow, you can actually do that. Right? You can imagine that meadow, and when you imagine it, that whole world comes from you, is sustained by you, resolves into you. But that imaginal world doesn't change you or touch you in any way. But when it is there, the whole world enjoys your being. So to say that consciousness doesn't do anything is not quite right. But what it does through Maya, which is natural to it, but doesn't bring about any change to it. So there's a lot of stuff that has to be unfolded for you around this.
Well, it seems the Maya seems like spectacular component to it. Just like the light on a movie screen, yes, without the light you can't see the flickering images, but it's the flickering images that create the attention. The light itself allows the flickering images to
The
happen.
Only difference I would say is that what if the light is the conscious, well, there are some good things about that example, but it's lacking in terms of being.
Well, that's what I mean when I say it seems unremarkable, because if it's that intimate, I get the idea that I can locate myself,
uh-huh.
but yet that self doesn't seem to hold my attention, to not might make me want to wander around in Maya. Somehow, it's not potent enough. To just end it right there. Yet I still feel that I can locate it. So when I do locate it, then what am I locating? Is it not that sense of beingness? Then why is that sense of beingness not potent enough to make me understand that its nature is ananda?
I don't know. I think maybe because your mind is very extrovert, and the ananda
mm-hmm.
that is potent and is everything to you has been projected out onto an object in the world or situation in the world, and so that's where your love and the potency is.
Yes.
But the problem is that's fine, and that is exactly what samsara is that what is potent, what is the love and the passion and what I want and my desire is projected onto things in the world, and then I go after them and I get them, but invariably that potency will fall off of those objects and then I'll move on. So we just keep moving on and on and on to from this potent experience to this potent, leaving behind, you know, a lot of waste products.
Sure.
So now what we're trying to do is ask, where does that potent, what is the source of that potent experience that captivates me?
Yes.
And the discovery will end up being that potent experience that is so captivating is actually the very nature of the self.
Yes.
But at this moment, your mind's not in a place to recognize that because it has already been projected out there. And so I have to reel that projection in.
Yes, that's why people meditate.
Well, yeah, but meditating is good as long as you know what you're doing. Because if you meditate, you can be having an experience and now you become addicted to that objectified experience, which is just a shantavritti, which then you want to get again and again and again. So in the end, you have to get back to your own self. But, you know, it takes a little time. Anyway, good question.
So I had two questions, I think both of which are probably naive. The first is, you talked about these basic elements and one of them being space, and I wondered what category time fits in. I also often think of time and space.
Yeah, we put time and space together, but time is like a byproduct of change.
Okay.
Without change, there is no time.
Right.
Yeah. So.
So it's not actually an element, it's something.
It's not really an element.
It comes from change.
It comes from change, and that's why time is so changing. Like Swamiji will use the example sometimes, is like if you're with your beloved, time flies by, and if you're waiting at the bus stop, it can go by really slowly. You know, but it is a marking of time. It is a marking of change, and you need duality for there to be time.
The other question was about the elements. Now, it seemed to me that earth, in its most pure form, when you might just be created. Like I was thinking of the very top of a tall mountain, and it's just sort of crumbling, like the granite is crumbling. It might not actually, at that point, have a smell. You know, in a sense, it would just be like granite
Sure, earth. It could be like a smell doesn't mean stink or anything.
No, but it might scent. Not. I mean, I smell like granite that's been maybe washed by water. And, you know, I mean, granite in itself doesn't seem to have a smell, even though it's an earth.
But I don't think that matters. It doesn't have to have a smell.
Okay.
But the thing that would have a smell would be earth.
Okay.
Like even if in water, they'll say in water, if there's a scent in water, that's from the earth particles.
I see.
Yeah.
So the other one that I thought of was about fire, in that I've always associated that with the smell. Now, I know
That's interesting.
I mean, because I guess every experience I've had of fire is a little kid at roasting marshmallows or whatever it might be. Or you
but
know,
smoke also, but smoke is earth, right?
Right. So fire in its, I mean, I kept talking
the smoke
about what fire
smell.
In its pure form would be. Let's say even with a match, it has a smell. I mean,
the wood.
Yeah, I know,
the
but where do you ever get fire without anything else? I mean, can we even imagine just pure fire, like maybe the sun, I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't think you have to worry too much about that. You can kind of understand it in principle and
broad strokes.
It's
a very beautiful, elegant system.
It's broad strokes.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, when you say you prostrate to this pramana or this method of teaching, what
it's just because in the tradition you're always, you know, the shraddha.
Mm-hmm.
Shraddha is always to the Upanishad and to the Acharya.
Hmm.
And so without the Shraddha, therefore, for both, its knowledge won't happen because your mind's not available.
Hmm.
You need to have both. Like say that you have Shraddha in the teacher, in the teaching, but you go to a teacher that you don't have Shraddha in, even though they're teaching that teaching.
Hmm.
Right? Because this is a living teaching. So if you don't have any shraddha in the teacher, your mind is not available your mind's not available for it. You know? And for this knowledge, to take place, your mind has to be available. Even in the world, it's not that different, really. Say you're studying chemistry or psychology or anything,
right.
You know. You want to know that the textbook that you're studying, you know, you have certain shraddha in it, that this is really a valuable resource.
The shraddha like faith?
Yeah, in Vedanta it's called like faith pending understanding, which is different than say faith in heaven or something like that, which is you just have to believe it. But here, faith is not quite the right word, but kind of. It's where your heart and mind are open to listening. It's also not at all about not questioning. You can have as many doubts as you want, but then the mind still has to be available to listen, you know?
Well, can you command yourself to have that openness?
I actually don't think that you really can, because if you can command yourself, you already have it. You know? Because your shraddha is overriding the doubts. Your shraddha comes in and says, no, let me just listen. You know? That's why they actually say that shraddha is Ishvara Nugraha. It means grace of Bhagavan, Bhagavan's grace. Because you can't really command it.
Yeah.
They say lifetimes and lifetimes of punya.
Mm. Really?
Yeah. Can't you position a person to enable, to evoke the potential for Shraddha? Can you position them with the teaching?
Well, yeah, but they have to be there. You can, sure. I mean, the Shraddha goes on increasing, but
they have to turn up. Well, they have to know you.
Yeah, they have to show up and be able to stick it out. The Shraddha becomes more and more and more, actually, because it's not. It loses the Shraddha and becomes knowledge. The Shraddha gets converted into knowledge, right? Which strengthens the part that's still Shraddha. Shraddha converts into knowledge, right? But say, as you start to have clarity, then you have more Shraddha.
Right. What's the role of miracles in Shraddha? If you performed a miracle, then say, oh, Carol must have huge knowledge. Or,
it would probably be a real obstacle.
I don't know, we'll give it a go. Do us a miracle right now.
Yeah, but then, I mean, we're all joking, but actually those things are big... big obstructions, because then you think that self-knowledge has something to do with siddhis or with miracles, and it doesn't. It just takes you another step farther away.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
She's very light.